You say you are morally obligated to do remarkable things.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, I think partly because life is so difficult and challenging that unless you give it everything you have, the chances are very high that it will embitter you, and then you'll be a force for darkness and not good. And so, you know, the fact that life is short and can be brutal can terrify you into hiding and avoiding. You can flip that on its head and understand that since you're all in anyways, you might as well take the risks that are adventurous. There isn't anything more adventurous than the truth. So why is that a moral obligation? Well, if you hide and you don't let what's inside of you out and you don't bring into the world what you could bring and you become cynical and bitter, you will start doing very dark things. Not only will you not add to the world what you could add, but you'll start being jealous of people who are competent and doing well and work to destroy them. So that's the pathway to hell. Really. We need to separate out the distinction between fantasy and delusion. You do have a fantasy about the future, so you have to provisionally map the future. That's what a plan is. That doesn't make it a delusion. Like, it becomes a delusion when the map bears no relationship to the underlying territory. So if you have a strategy for the future, you know, maybe let's say that your strategy for the future is that you have 5 million YouTube subscribers in 3 years. Well, you have no evidence of the strict sort that that's how it's going to be, because anything could happen between now and 3 years from now, let's say. But there's no reason to call that a delusion. It's one hypothetically possible path of potential. And then you can make the sacrifices necessary to bring that about. So even though it's a fantasy, because it maps something that isn't there, it's not a delusion. It's a delusion when you're ignoring elements of your own experience that would inform your fantasy more effectively. You're ignoring them so that you can live in a positive representation of the future without having to pay the appropriate price for it. The ultimate ideal is also the ultimate judge, because the ultimate ideal is something against which you fall far short. And that might be so painful that you can barely stand it. But then what you do is you, two things, I suppose, is you lower the ideal and you raise your estimation of your potential. And what do I mean by lower the ideal? Well, if you're comparing yourself to someone or even to a future self and the gap is so painful that it paralyzes you, then you've created a dragon that you don't have the tools to master. And so what you have to do is you have to scale the dragon down to size. And you want to scale the dragon down to size until it's a size that you are willing to move toward, however small that is. Now, you know, if you're here and your ideal is here and that gap is unbearable, then you reduce the gap and you reduce the gap. And you're going to have to do that anyways, because you're not going to move from where you are to perfect in one fell swoop, right? There's going to be incremental steps. So you have to fill in that hierarchy of progression with a high enough resolution representation so that you can start to move forward. There's another gospel comment that's very interesting. It's called the Matthew principle. And the Matthew principle is, to those who have everything, more will be given. And from those who have nothing, everything will be taken. Now, it's brutal because it implies that reality works like this. When you're moving up, you go like this, right? And that's pretty nice. That's a lot better than this. But when you're going down, you go like that, right? It's like downhill, downhill, cliff. Okay, so you want to avoid the downhill path. Well, if the uphill path is like this, which is like exponential, let's say, or geometric, then what that means is that it doesn't matter how big the first steps you take uphill are, even if they're trivial, even if they're shameful in their size, because you're so useless. If you're disciplined in that, you'll speed up extraordinarily rapidly. And so that's the good news, you might say, is that you can take very small steps, even ones that might be shameful in their size, and you have to admit that to yourself. But once you get the ball rolling, it doesn't roll in a linear fashion, it rolls in a geometric fashion. And this is a really good thing to know, because it can take the sting out of the realization of your own stupidity. It's like, yeah, you know, everybody has their weak sides, let's say, things they're embarrassed about. When I first started going to the gym, I was like 23, and I think I weighed 135 pounds, and I was 6'1", very, very thin, 27-inch waist, something like that. And I smoked like mad, and I drank too much. Like, I wasn't in good shape. The first attempts forward I took in the gym, I went to this swimsercise class. Jesus, it was me and this like really fat guy, young guy, probably not in any worse shape than me, and like seven old women over 70, and they could outswim me. Like, it was pretty damn humiliating. And so I did a semester of that and got myself in somewhat better shape. And then I started to go to the gym to work out, to lift weights. And that was also rough because, you know, I'd be underneath the bloody bench press trying to lift 75 pounds off the rests. And, you know, some muscle-headed bastard would come over and tell me how to do it. And it's like, yeah, thank you. But, you know, it's embarrassing. And lots of times people won't do things like go to the gym because they're so embarrassed about how they look or what sort of shape they're in. And it's a pain to start at the bottom, but you start at the bottom where you're weak. And if you want to rectify what's weak, you have to accept the fact that you're at the bottom and that the first steps are going to be painful. You know, it took me about 3 years, but I stopped smoking and then I stopped drinking and I gained 40 pounds of muscle in like 3.5 years, something like that. I basically had to stop doing that because I had to eat like 6 times a day. It was crazy. But I got a lot more physically confident and a lot more coordinated. But the point of all this is, if you're going to rectify your weaknesses, you have to admit your insufficiency to your own shame. Now, if the gap between you and your ideal is so great that it paralyzes you, you shrink that. Things will beckon to you and call to you, and you'll have intuitions about which pathway to take. And you will, in all likelihood, follow those, because what else do you have? You have these orienting instincts. This is another reason why you don't lie. Because if you lie and you practice lying, you pathologize your instincts. And then your intuitions lead you wrong. And so there's a sin that's laid out in the Gospels. It's the sin against the Holy Ghost. And it's unforgivable. And people have been debating for like 2,000 years about what this particular sin is. But it's something like the pathologization of the instincts that orient you. Like, if you sacrifice your relationship to the truth, you warp your vision. And then you can't see. And then one day it'll be dark and there'll be sharp things in the fog in front of you. And you'll wander right into them because you've pathologized your own vision.
Yeah.
You don't want to lie. Because you program yourself falsely, and then you automatically see what isn't there. And then, of course, the world will slap you in the face continually, and you'll think, oh my God, the world's such a pathological place. When the truth of the matter is that, no, you just keep running into things that you refuse to see. And then you think, well, the world's made of nothing but obstacles. It's like, well, you put the obstacles in your own path, and you did that by developing these complex, self-serving delusions, a story that you tell other people about who you are that isn't true. You're trying to lay out a map that bears no relationship to reality, and you keep wondering why you wander off the path and into a pit. It's like, well, how could it be otherwise? People have commented to me many times about my bravery, and I don't like that. It's not right. I'm afraid of different things than the typical person. Maybe that's a good way of thinking about it. I'm way more afraid of the consequences of saying something that's false or wandering off the appropriate path than I am of whatever consequences might come for saying what I believe and doing what I believe to be the case. I'm way more afraid of that. You know, I've been reading the Gospel of St. Matthew. I'm writing a book at the moment called We Who Wrestle with God. And one of the things Christ says to people continually is to not damage their vision, is to not put, that's the best way of putting it, don't occlude your eye. You can see what's in front of you if you're willing to see it. And if you're willing to see it, many of the terrible obstacles in life, you can just walk around. But if you blind yourself purposefully to follow your own narrow, self-serving delusion, you're going to run into terrible things and terrible people and the terrible part of your own soul all the time. That's what you should be afraid of. You can't be isolated, alone, without responsibility, and pursuing your hedonistic nonsense and not be insane and miserable. Those are all the same thing, right? And so, you know, it's got to the point, I've said things that have made me somewhat unpopular, like it's very difficult for people to mature until they have a child. You find a huge part of what you are in that relationship. It makes you responsible, makes you grow up. It gives you the opportunity to mentor someone. You have someone around who's more important than you. Well, that's part of being mentally healthy. It's a huge part of it. This enterprise that I've helped put together, Alliance for Responsible Citizenship, we're trying to put forward a model of governance. It's called a subsidiary model. And the idea is that people have multiple social roles that scale. No, there's you. You should take care of yourself, integrate yourself, which means you can conduct yourself properly across the medium to long run. You're self-sustaining. Then you can maybe extend that to your partner and then to your family and then to your local community and then to broader communities as you become more and more competent and able to take on that responsibility. That's the alternative to isolated hedonic slavery. You're slave to your own whims. And it's the alternative to tyranny, because if you take on all that responsibility, you don't have any need for someone to govern you. It's truly the case that your sanity is the concordance between you as an individual and the world. That's the sanity. You're distributed out into the world, and you should be, and that's, you want to be. That's where the adventure is. You want to be solipsistic? The solipsistic porn masturbator. Jesus, it's no wonder you'd be aimless and miserable. Well, God, it's so pathetic. Why am I so unhappy? It's because you think about yourself. Oh, no, you think about the lowest impulses in yourself all the time. That's why you're miserable. People exist in a sacrificial relationship to the world. What does that mean? It seems to mean something like, human beings are aware of their extended self. You know you're going to be around tomorrow and next week and next month and next year and 5 years from now and 10 years from now. Now it's less certain as you go out, but you do have the sense of yourself as something that stretches across the decades. Okay, and so what that means is that you have to conduct yourself in a manner that isn't merely immediate. You have to conduct yourself in a manner that will work across time. Now, how do people do that? They work. Work is a sacrificial gesture. So you work by definition, virtually. Work is the sacrifice of the present for the future. I mean, maybe someone can come up with a better definition of work than that, but I don't think so. It's like you put in time and effort right now, even if it's something not what you'd like to be doing at the moment, you put in time and effort because you believe, what the hell does that mean? You believe it'll pay off. Well, is that a contract with the future? Is it a covenant? Because the relationship that the biblical corpus characterizes human striving is covenantal. It's a bargain. The bargain is you make the right sacrifices and they pay off. That's the bargain. Now, you might say, well, that's just part of the social contract, but the biblical corpus insists that it's deeper than that. It's built into the structure of reality itself. And that if you got the sacrifices right, the future would be paradisal. Well, that's a kind of sacrifice right there, is that you're willing to sacrifice your short-term physiological and psychological comfort for a medium to long-term benefit. It's the essence of sacrifice. This is something the atheists don't understand about the biblical narrative, is that the narrative insists that we live in a sacrificial relationship. It's the essence of humanity to live in a sacrificial relationship. It's like, well, is that true or not? Well, as you mature, your relationships are more sacrificial. It's less about what you, in your narrow sense, want right now, and it's more about what's good over the medium to long run, including other people. Well, that's a sacrificial relationship. Now, the covenant, you know, and this is a matter of faith. It's the matter of the deepest faith. Are you willing to act out the proposition that the way to make the world reveal itself to you in its most positive guise is for you to adopt the most appropriate sacrificial relationship? Well, it's a big risk, isn't it? Because you have to give up everything. That's the deal. You give up everything that's low. Everything. Everything. Well, that's what the Christian passion is, because the Christian passion is an archetypal story, because Christ is the person who sacrifices everything thoroughly, 100%. There's no indecision because you age. Like, you pay for your indecision. It's a decision. It's a decision to avoid fundamentally. No, and part of the moral that's embedded in the story of Job and in the Christian passion is that you can master what you'll face. And maybe that's true. I mean, the clinical literature seems to indicate that it's true, because one of the things you do, if you're a competent clinician, is you look at what people are attempting to accomplish, and maybe that needs some retooling, but let's assume that they have a goal in mind that would work, right? You've talked it through with them strategically. They have a well laid out vision. Okay, now they're laying out the vision and they encounter impediments that stop them. And maybe they're impediments that make them afraid and paralyze them. And so then what you do is you decompose the impediment until you find a way they can advance that constitutes a genuine advance that they'll actually do. So what you do is you take the problem and you narrow it until they'll face it. Okay, then they face it. Then what happens? They get more competent. That's what happens. And then they get better at facing all problems. So they don't just learn how to deal with that specific problem. They learn a lesson that generalizes across problems. They get braver. When you use exposure therapy, people don't get less afraid. They get braver. And that's way better. Because braver moves from situation to situation. Okay, so the question is, if you faced everything that was put in front of you, who would you be? Well, the answer, the biblical answer is you'd be a true son of God. That's the biblical answer. It's like, well, do you believe that? Well, it depends on what you mean by believe. Do you have a better bet than facing what's there? Well, you just have to be sensible about it for a moment. It's like, is your theory that you're going to adapt better using falsehood and avoidance? Because that's the contrary theory. You either face it, and you do that predicated on the faith that something in you will respond if you do, or you don't face it. That's it. Those are the options. If you don't face it, that's faith too. That's faith in the notion that avoidance and deception will suffice. There's technically two different forms of reward. There's consummatory reward. That's what an orgasm is. It's consummatory reward. It brings the behavioral and perceptual sequence to a halt. It ends it, right? At the climax, it ends it. But then it's over. That journey is over, right? Then there's the dopaminergic reward. And dopaminergic reward is evidence of advancement towards a goal, right? Okay, so there's a corollary to that. Well, how do you become optimally engaged? Because dopamine facilitates engagement and focus, which is why drugs like amphetamines can be used for kids who are attention deficit disordered. You tap up the dopamine response, they lock on, right? Okay, so they're locking on to a goal-directed pursuit. The problem with amphetamines is that they can lock you on so hard you can't get out of the frame. So like kids on amphetamines will obsess, for example, about cleaning up their closet. They can't switch to the next activity. Okay, dopaminergic reward is reward that's accrued in relationship to a goal. Okay, so what's an implication of that? Well, pursue the highest possible goal. Well, why? Because the kick from advancement is higher. Now, you have to balance that. It can't be, you have to advance, right? Because imagine the reward's got two components. Number one is you're moving towards something valuable. Okay, so you want it to be as valuable as possible. Okay, but you have to be moving. You need something extremely valuable that you can move towards. Okay, so part of the reason that you establish a relationship with God, let's say, is because that's what sets the upper bound to your vision. It's like, I want things to be the best they could be. That's a vision of paradise. Well, that has to be fractionated into, you know, your proximal decisions, but lurking behind that should be this continual movement towards, what would you say, a heaven that recedes as you approach it. That's the proper vision of heaven. A heaven is a place that's perfect and getting better, both at the same time. That's what music shows you, because a great piece of music is perfect, but it's just getting better as it unfolds. And you need that. This is part of the problem with a static utopian vision, something Dostoevsky criticized. If you gave people nothing but consummatory reward, he famously says, so that they can do nothing but sit in tubs of hot water, eat cake, and busy themselves with the continuation of the species, human beings would break that all to hell in a moment just so they have something interesting to do. If you run yourself through a disciplinary process, so you accomplish something, maybe you don't attain the goal you were aiming at, but you accrue a new way of looking at the world and a set of skills. Well, if you just keep doing that, you have multiple ways of looking at the world and more skill. Well, that's your storehouse of treasure. As you walk through life in your normal mode, things will call to you. And if you pursue them, they will take you deep. It doesn't really matter what it is that calls. What matters is that you pursue it and you pursue it to the depths. And as you pursue it to the depths, you will become transformed. And if you do that without reservation, that will turn you into the person who frees the slaves and opposes the tyrants. And that is how it works. That's the call. And that can happen in any direction, virtually any direction. You just have to pursue it with sufficient faith. Aimless is not nothing. Aimless is bad. Nietzsche said if you had a why, you could bear any how.
Most people find the meaning in their life through responsibility. I believe the fundamental religious truth of the idea that life is suffering. It's suffering because we're mortal and fragile, and because we're also subject to malevolence at our own hands and at the hands of others. It's a constant existential problem. And that can make you bitter and can make you hopeless and nihilistic and depressed and anxious and likely to abuse substances of various sorts as a medication or an escape. It can auger you in a very large number of ways. And I'm suggesting to people that there is a way out of that. And the way out is to confront that forthrightly and to adopt responsibility in your own life and to try to make the world a better place, and that it's necessary to do that. And that if you don't do that, that things go badly. I think the deck is stacked against everyone to some degree, because life is very difficult and we all die. But some people do have it harder than others. And all of us have it very hard at some times in our lives. It's like, well, what's the alternative? You take responsibility for that and try to struggle uphill, because the alternative makes everything worse. Find something in your life that's so worthwhile doing that the fact that you're going to suffer is justifiable. Yeah, life's rough, no doubt about it. And if good luck comes your way, then you should be grateful for it. And if happiness manages to manifest itself, you should be grateful for that too.
So then you might ask yourself, well, what's the best antidote to the discomfort of life? And you might say, well, it's comfort. And I suppose that's what you act out when you swaddle a baby. But a better antidote is something like adventure to excellence. And that's far better antidote to suffering than the mere absence of suffering. So not to say that the mere absence of suffering, that's not nothing.
I've been a psychotherapist for 20 years. I've seen things you can't imagine. Horror shows that you can't fathom, and people who have been hurt in so many ways, so many dimensions. It's like, should they be bitter? Should they be resentful? Should they become violent? These things don't help. They have to struggle uphill despite their excess burden. And it's responsibility, not guilt.
It's the female crucifixion. So, and that's exemplified best in, well, the best portrayal of that I've seen is Michelangelo's Pieta. You know, it's a statue of Mary, and she has Christ's body on her, as an adult, on her lap, and yep. He's broken and destroyed, and, you know, she's displaying that. And that's the bravery of a mother, to allow that to happen. But not only that, to facilitate it. Facilitate it. Way you go, kid. Way you go. Way you go. Well, why? It's dangerous out there. It's like, yeah, no kidding. It's more dangerous here if you stay with me. By a lot. So you might lose your body out there in the world, but if you stay here, you lose your soul.
You know, I mean, it's a pretty competitive world. There's lots of competition for young men in particular. There's competition for status and limited resources and for the attention of women. And just because you're nice doesn't necessarily mean that you come out particularly well in those competitions.
I would like to say that you should all be smarter, but I don't know how you could be smarter. We don't know anything about how to improve intelligence, and I suppose we don't really know anything about how to improve industriousness either, but I can tell you that people who are industrious come up with a strategy for solving the problem that's ahead of them, and then they do whatever they can to stick to the strategy. And so, for example, if you sat down today or tomorrow for a couple of hours, 3 hours, and you filled in a Google Calendar, whatever you happen to use, with a strategy for studying, and a list of when all your assignments are due and all of that, and when you're going to sit down and study, then you won't be in a position where you have to cram for 10 hours a day hopelessly right before, you know, an important exam.
It's beautifully put that love is the highest ideal to reach for, and truth is...
It's handmade. I thought about that for a long time, right? This hierarchy of ideal. And the thing about truth, that bitter truth, let's say, that cynical truth, is it can break the shackles of naivety. And actually, a burnt cynicism is a moral improvement over a blind naivety, even though one is in some ways positive, but only because it's protected, and the other is bitter and dark, but still better. But you're not done at that point. You're just barely started.
I think optimally we exist to have something like a playful adventure, right? We're built for an optimal challenge. It's partly why we like to play, because in play you find an optimal challenge. It's almost like the definition of play. And so if you can organize yourself and the world optimally, then you have adventure. And maybe you have the adventure of your life. And if you can do that brilliantly, then you can do it in a spirit of play. That's what you need and want.
I saw an endless repetition in my clinical practice and in my own private life when my eyes were open, the consequences of not saying what was true. It's like whatever hell you might fall into by opening your mouth when you have something to say that isn't popular, it's nothing like the hell that you're going to envelop yourself in if you lose control of your own tongue and mind. And I, like I said, in my clinical practice, I never saw anyone get away with anything even once. And so all you have in a situation like that is what is the truth. Now, you know, of course, you only have your approximations to the truth, but that's better than nothing. And so you need to be afraid of the right thing, and you should be afraid of contaminating your soul with deceit. That's what you should be afraid of. What happens is, you know, garbage in, garbage out, the old programmer saying goes, and so you'll fill your head with nonsense and no one will call you on it except you, but you can still that voice if you try hard enough. You just wait until you get in real trouble. You know, one day there'll come a point where you have to make a decision. And the decision is the difference between life and death, or worse, between someone else's life and death, or worse, between health and the suffering that's worse than death. And because you've compromised yourself to such a degree, you will not be able to rely on your judgment, and you will make the mistake you shouldn't make. And then you're done. And that will absolutely happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, you set what's great against what's tragic.
Yeah.
I mean, what else could you possibly do? And so then you say, well, how do you find what's great in your own life? And part of that is you watch. It's like, when is it that I'm doing something that alleviates my suffering, right? Mm. It's real. You have to ask that question to yourself honestly. One of the things you have them do is say, well, why don't you just watch for a week? Like, watch yourself like you don't know who you are and just see when you're not quite as miserable. Yeah. And then let's see if we can figure out what it is about what you're doing in that situation that's lifting the gloom. It's like, okay, there's something in that that's curative, right? And that's something in that that's curative is related to, well, you might say your purpose. It's like maybe part of the reason you're depressed is because you're too isolated. Well, now we can work on that. So let's see if we can increase the amount of time you're spending with your friends by like 20%. Or maybe you need a couple of new friends. Or maybe you need to work on your comic material, you know, because you can set that against the tragedy of life.
This is, I think, why people are so obsessed in some sense with the search for fundamental meaning. This is a good story. So you can imagine two people laying bricks, they're building a gigantic wall, and the one person thinks, oh my God, you know, this wall is going to take 100,000 bricks. I'm laying one at a time and I'm wasting my life away, trivially adding to this gigantic brick wall, and what am I doing? This is absolutely miserable, brick by brick. And the other person thinks, in 300 years, this is going to be a cathedral. And so the person in the second state is doing exactly the same thing at a local level, laying bricks, but each brick is related to a very high goal. And that means the reward that's attendant upon the laying of the brick is proportional to the goal of the entire behavioral process. So if you're aimless and goalless, then you can't elicit any positive emotion. And if your goals are fragmented, which is also what happens if you're aimless or your goals lack unity, if your goals are fragmented, then no given behavioral manifestation can elicit any dopaminergic reward because it's not a step forward to anything desirable. One of the things, well, I did write about this in my first book, particularly about putting your life, putting your house in perfect order. It's like, well, if you're lost, one of the things you can do is look around and see what direction you could take locally. Fix something. Find something that you could do that would make things better that you would do. And there's a humility in that too, because especially if you're in a low energy state, it's like, oh my God, you know, I don't have enough energy to make dinner. It's like, do you have enough energy to put a fork on the table? And sometimes people are so depressed that that's really all they can do. Can you take a small step forward, no matter how small that is? Implement a micro routine, even something like washing a cup and putting it back in the shelf. And you know that's a good thing because you have a shelf and there's cups on it. You've already decided that's an appropriate way to live, is to have your coffee cups on a shelf. If you go ahead with cleaning out the cup and putting it on the shelf, then you've taken steps towards a valuable micro goal. You get a dopamine kick from that. That transforms itself into adrenaline and energizes you. In part, what the dopamine system is doing. So imagine that the purpose of the dopamine system is to elicit a satiating reward, fundamentally. But then the satiating reward is something that has to be approached in steps. And so in order to maintain the motivation necessary to approach the satiating reward, you have to mark each of the steps with a marker of pleasure. Small things are not small. You might have the cognitive appraisal that doing something local, like cleaning up your room, is small, but it's not obvious at all that that's the case. It's not that trivial to put your immediate surroundings in order, and it can easily be the stepping stone to putting things in order on a broader scale. In fact, it's probably the necessary stepping stone to do that. You can pat yourself on the back, especially if you're depressed, a little harder than you might otherwise by saying, you know, you say, well, this is trivial, but I did it. It's like, no, if you're moving ahead, that's not small. You just keep doing that, you're going to get out of this paralyzed or retreat mode. If you're in the zone of proximal development, you're pushing your skill development one increment forward. And it's one that you can actually manage. Imagine that you have someone who's habitually avoidant. And maybe they're avoidant because when they become possessed by negative emotion, they become hyper aware of their internal state and they feel the panic. And so then they freeze or retreat. And they do that constantly. And then they're in this terrible negative emotional state all the time because every time they see a stimulus that's associated with retreat, they get gripped by these interoceptive sensations. And so you say to them, well, we're going to reverse that. Instead of you being gripped by that, you're going to expose yourself to that voluntarily. See, if you do that repeatedly with people, not only do they stop being afraid of the things that you're showing them, that you're exposing them to, but they become more likely to approach other things they're afraid of, far more likely. In fact, it doesn't exactly look like people get more less afraid at all. It looks like what happens is they learn to get braver. One of the cognitive phenomena, that loads very heavily on neuroticism is self-consciousness. And so when you fall into anxiety, then there is this internal obsessiveness, which has to do with the panoply of sins in some sense. Which parts of me are malfunctioning and need to be eradicated? And one of the things I used to do with my socially anxious clients, so they would go into a social situation, often with eyes downcast, by the way, and they would be so intensely concentrating on their own internal sensations that they would fail to make eye contact with anybody they were talking to. And then they would be awkward because they weren't reading the cues they could have read if they would have only looked. And then the conversation would become disjointed. And then they would get anxious and fall into themselves. And so one of the things that I taught them to do wasn't to try to calm themselves down, but to try to calm the other person down. So when you go into a social situation, pay more attention to the other person. Like, just focus your attention outward. And if the person had any social skill, sometimes I had clients who had no social skills. And so they were anxious socially because they actually didn't know how to behave socially. So then you had to teach them the social skills. But some of them had the skills but wouldn't activate them because they were so neurotically obsessed with their own inadequacy
that they failed to attend to the cues that would elicit the proper responses. And all they had to learn to do was watch. And then they would automatically respond because they knew how to have a conversation. See, the reason that socially anxious people are so interoceptive is it's involuntary, right? They get gripped by the negative emotion, and then that produces this intense, obsessive interoception. That might not happen if they did it voluntarily. This is why exposure therapy works so well in psychotherapy. Is like, well, I'm afraid of something, and if I go near it, then I'm possessed by negative emotion. Well, that's if you go near it accidentally. I'm going to have you go near it purposefully. And what you're going to find is that to the degree that you do it purposefully, that response will be quelled. And that happens. It's extraordinarily reliable. Imagine you anticipate something and then you make a mistake. Now the question then becomes, how significant is the mistake? The depressive takes that punishment response, let's say, that's a consequence of failed anticipation and can't bind it. It just takes out all of their potential future selves. And so then they're in a depressive pit. That's too much learning from failure. That binding problem is really tricky. One of the rules of thumb for that that's extremely useful, that's socially instantiated, is innocent until proven guilty. So you might say, when those thoughts come up, because they're adversarial and accusatory thoughts, you might say, well, that is part of the realm of possibility. But when your child does something wrong that's minor, you don't say you're a rotten kid. You bind it. You say, look, kid, here's a bunch of things you're doing right. But in this particular example, specific situation, here's the minimal thing you did incorrectly and how to alter it. And it's a really good habit of mind to address towards yourself as well as to other people, which is to say, well, what's the minimum crime that I'm responsible for in this moment? And that's part of this miracle of the presumption of innocence, and especially without proof. A lot of what I did in my clinical practice to people who had a depressive temperament was help them make a case for themselves. It's like, well, maybe you're as bad as you think you might be, but maybe not. Let's take the contrary argument and only narrow the repair to the absolute minimum that needs to be manifested. Sometimes when you make one little mistake, it is actually an indicator of a flaw in your character. But most of the time it isn't. And it certainly can't be responded to that all the time, because then you'd never be able to make a mistake without wiping yourself completely out. You want to make it as local and precise as you possibly can. And that's also one of the advantages to removing yourself from a rage or an anxiety state, because a rage or an anxiety state is low resolution and global. And so it'll be globally accusatory. So you want to specify it and you think, okay, well, what's the minimum necessary behavioral transformation to ensure that similar mistakes are not replicated in the future? It's like if your roof leaks, you don't have to dig a new foundation. You can just fix a few shingles. And you might think, well, the rain's coming through, so you have to tear down the whole house. It's like, well, no. And you might panic and run around because the water's coming in, but it's still a bad idea to dig up the foundations every time something trivial maintenance problem needs to emerge. And so one of the things that's very useful to learn is like, well, is this only a trivial maintenance problem? And one of the advantages to that too is that if it's not the collapse of your entire self, let's say, and it's a trivial maintenance problem, you're much more able to activate that courageous response to anomaly that's part and parcel of exploratory behavior and eventual success. So, and part of the trick of many sorts of, well, I would say religious training enterprises, certainly the meditative enterprises, is something like, how do you tell yourself a story, like a real story, though, a story that actually works, where you can confidently approach the thing that's blocking your path?
Sometimes you take a leap forward and you learn some things, but you can't catalyze a new identity, so you try to go back and hide in your old identity. And that actually doesn't work, because, well, things have changed and you've learned something and that isn't who you are anymore. And so it's like you have to cut parts of yourself off in a destructive manner to fit back into the person that you were. One of the times in your life when you actually realize that you're an individual is when you'll go and ask your parents something and you'll realize they actually don't know any more about what you should do than you do. And that sucks. And that's partly why people are often willing to maintain a tyrant-slave relationship with their father. It's like, on the one hand, you have to be inferior in a relationship like that. You know, you've always got the judge watching you. But on the other hand, there's always someone who knows what to do. There's always someone standing between you and the unknown that you can go ask, what should I do? Well, at some point, you'll realize that the reason you can't ask that anymore is because they actually don't know any more than you do. And then that's a pain, like that is a symbolic death. And that's also when you establish a more individual relationship with your parents. It's at that point that you could conceivably start taking care of them instead of the reverse. And that's a time that should come. But you have to let that image of perfection go. And that exposes you.